With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from The New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week we're going to be talking about the Edinburgh Festival and the TV adaptation of J.K. Rowling's crime novel The Cuckoo's Calling.
We've also listened to the BBC radio series Love in Recovery for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously.
It is nearly here. The time has nearly arrived. Our very busy week of Seriously events is just, what, 10 days away now?
That's about it.
Yeah, so on the 12th of September, you get a final chance to air your Game of Thrones thoughts with us. Game of Thrones quiz at the book club in Shoreditch. There are a handful of tickets left, not many at all, so definitely come along. I know Anna's plotting some post-season 7 spoilery questions to liven things up a bit. Not that it needs that, it was a very lively night last time. And then on the Sunday of that week, on the 17th, we're doing a live episode at the London Podcast Festival, which we would love if you would come along. If you want to get tickets, seriouslypod.com/events. It's all on there.
Great. Well, I really hope as many people come as possible. I'm excited. We just love to do events, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And the live episode we did at the Shout Out Festival before was loads of fun. Like, actually a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. I was quite nervous about it, but it turns out that actually just sitting on a stage and doing this is not that different to sitting in a room on our own and doing this, apart from better because there are nice people there.
And the audience was great, which really helps. So
yeah,
it's nice to
definitely.
Have friendly faces in the crowd.
Yeah. Also, if you are in Britain or on the internet, I feel you can't fail to have noticed that the Great British Bake Off is back tonight, Tuesday, as we record this. Obviously, it's a bit controversial. This is its first episode since moving from the BBC. There's not going to be any Mary, no Mel and Sue. I've seen lots of people on social media saying that they are, you know, watching one to give it a chance to see how it goes, which is funny. I actually heard someone in the newsagent say that the other day as well.
I have actually seen the first episode.
What? TV critic privilege.
Yeah, though I don't know who went because they always chop off the end of the screeners for reviews. So they like don't allow you to see who's like the star baker or who goes home. And yeah, for me, like the reviews were really positive, but for me, it's not great. But the thing is, I feel like you do mainly watch the Bake Off actually for the contestants, less so than Mary and Mel and Sue and stuff. Like the contestants are always the best bit when you get really, really good contestants. And the contestants are good. But, like, the rest of it just, like, isn't up to scratch to me. There's one bit, like, no spoilers, but there was one bit right at the beginning where Prue Leith said, well, you know, it's cake week and the important thing about cakes is, you know, that you have to make sure they're worth the calories. And I was like, ugh,
what?
This isn't in the spirit of the Bake Off. Why are you mentioning calories? Like, 5 seconds into the first episode. Like, what a way to make people, like, feel guilty about this, like, show that delights in sugar. I feel really, I don't know,
yeah.
I didn't like that at all. So, like, things like that for me are just like, this is not the Bake Off that I know and love. But anyway, we'll talk about it in more detail after I'm back from holiday, so in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, we're going to give it a couple of episodes and then we'll do a proper segment on it. But I just wanted to mention it now, partly because, you know, big pop culture event, but also because we're going to take part in the Fantasy Bake Off League, which I did last year with my housemates and it is the most fun. Even if you're not massively enjoying the programme, the competition within the league is very fun. It works like fantasy football. You log in at fantasybakeoff.co.uk, you sign up, and then you choose who you think is going to win Star Baker every week, who's going to leave, that kind of thing. And then it gives you points according to how well you predict. By the end of the series, you know, you want to be on top. So we've started our own Seriously League. It's really easy to join. Just drop us an email or send us a DM on Twitter and I'll send you the instructions for how to join. And join us in there. I would warn everyone that Amelia Tate, who wrote the article for the New Statesman, where she in-depth investigated all the contestants' social media to find out who she thinks will win, she is in the league. So I'd say she's the one to beat.
I don't know. I'm going to have to decide whether or not I can compete properly in this, though, because if I end up watching the episodes in advance every week, then that's going to be quite an unfair advantage.
That's true. Maybe so, we should disqualify you on the basis.
Yeah, I might have to be disqualified, or at least promise to like do my bit before I watch the episodes or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. You can make your nominations, I think, like as soon as the episode's over for the next week. So maybe we just have to put you on your honour that that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, exciting. So much exciting stuff to come. But I'd actually just had a very exciting week.
Yes, you've been to Edinburgh.
Yeah, I was in Edinburgh for two festivals. The more well-known Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is, of course, a festival that runs throughout August in Edinburgh. That's sort of comedy, theatre, a whole mix of different kinds of live shows. And also the lesser known Edinburgh TV Festival, which is an industry specific festival for kind of people who write TV and make TV programs, or perhaps they're PRs, or perhaps they're journalists who write about TV like me. Anyway, you know, people who live and work in the TV world. So I was there for that too, which was quite interesting. Like, there were lots of cool events about like where TV is going and stuff. And also I was at a lot of parties and did a lot of celeb spotting, being like, oh, look, there's Stephen Moffat over in the corner, or like, oh, Charlie Brooker's here, you know, that kind of thing. Like Rory Bremner. That's the kind of level that we're at. But yeah, that was fun. And I actually did get to see quite a lot of stuff at the Fringe, which I was worried that I wouldn't have time to do. But I basically did a lot of like literally running from show to show, which did mean a couple of times like they wouldn't let me in because I was like 2 minutes late or whatever, which was, you know, that was entirely my own fault. But I did get to see lots of shows at the Fringe. So we thought we might talk a little bit about the stuff that I saw last week, because it was a cultured time for me.
I feel like running between things at the Fringe is the authentic festival experience.
Yeah.
So what were your top three things you saw?
My top three? Oh, that's hard. I think my favourite thing that I saw, it's going to be so difficult to explain and you're going to be like, what is she talking about? But it was called Dollywood, as in, you know, Dollywood, Dolly Parton's theme park. Mm. Except spelt wood, as in, you know, what would Dolly Parton do?
I see.
It's by this company called Shit Theatre, and it's these two girls, and it was very, very odd. It's a show, like, rather than a play, but it is very scripted, and it's them talking about their obsession with Dolly Parton, and they, like, wear these outfits that are a bit Dolly Parton-esque, so they're wearing this sort of big, kind of white, woolly wig, and these, like, little denim cut-off shorts. And then at one point they also cut, you know, like Regina George cuts holes in her top in Mean Girls, or someone does it, you know, Janice does it, and then she's wearing, they do that, but they've got nothing on underneath. So they've just got their like breasts poking through these holes in their like pink vest tops for the vast majority of it. So they open with this kind of anecdote that they kind of deliver in a very rehearsed way about Dolly Parton like entering herself into a drag queen competition, like a Dolly Parton drag queen competition. So there are all these queens doing like a Dolly Parton lookalike contest where they've got like ridiculous wigs and so on. And Dolly Parton entered herself and like just did her wig way more extreme than usual, and like, do you know what I mean, like just really overdid her normal dress and makeup, and she lost. So they talk about that, but then they're also talking about all these other things. So they're really interested in Dolly the sheep, you know, Dolly the clone sheep.
Yeah.
So they're talking about that, and they tell a story about, you know, they keep saying things like Dolly grew up on a farm, she's totally unique, that's what we love about her, and you're not sure if they're talking about the sheep or the person. And also their wigs kind of look a bit sheepy, they're like woolly, And then occasionally they like bend over, and the fact that their boobs are poking out their t-shirt looks quite like animalistic when they bend over, and they look quite like sheep. So it's all weird, and they're making parallels between the person and the sheep. And then they're also talking about this, like, the other main attraction near Dollywood is a body farm where like they literally like leave bodies to decompose and people donate their bodies for it. And it's like, you know, a way of looking at how bodies decompose in different situations and stuff. And so they are also talking about this farm as well as like the farms that the Dollies grew up on. And it's all about like Dolly Parton's relationship with her body and like death. And like, it's really, really weird, but it was really funny. And there's like lots of like country music interspersed with it and really, really dark. And like, I left it just like, wow, that was amazing. It was like the equivalent of reading Maggie Nelson's Bluets in the way that it was so like connections being made between stuff that you just wouldn't expect it to be. But it was just so good. Anyway, that was a very long rambling explanation of what Dollywood is. But that's my favourite one by far. So I think if shit theatre do anything that is outside Edinburgh, keep your eyes peeled. Then my other two favourite things I saw, one I think you would like a lot, was a play called Education, Education, Education. And it's about teachers, and it's set the day after Tony Blair wins the election in 97. Mm. And it's just about these teachers like trying their best to like teach well in this school. And the cast play both teachers and students. And it was just really like very politically engaged, but also very human. And it's like got an amazing like 90s music soundtrack, and like there's like references to Tamagotchis and stuff, and there's a lot of like dance in it. It's like very choreographed, like not like dance, but just like people moving in weird ways. And it was just really funny and also really good. And at the end I like cried and like felt enraged at the state of education funding in our country, but it was great. So I think you'd like that one anyway. I don't know if it'll tour or anything, but keep your eyes peeled for Education, Education, Education.
Mm, that sounds really good. They should definitely do it at a Labour conference, if not anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Really know the audience. And then third, I would say I saw some stand-up by someone called Rose Matafeo. I don't know if you've heard of her. I think she is doing quite well.
No, I don't think so.
She's from New Zealand, but she lives in London, and she's really funny. And her stand-up was called Sassy Best Friend. And it was about, you know, that line in The Holiday where, I think, is it Jude Law who says to Kate Winslet, you're playing the sassy best friend in your own life. And she's talking about that and like her relationship with rom-coms. But she talks about loads of things, and it's really funny. Like, she loves Michael Jackson, even though he's problematic, and she talks about that and stuff. I just really liked it. And I think I imagine she's going to start doing quite well because there was a bit of buzz about her. And I know that she's done some other things. So yeah, Rose Matafeo would be third. So sorry for the very long, rambling explanation of my highlights, but those were my highlights from Edinburgh. Deaths.
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds really, really good. I attempted to vicariously enjoy Edinburgh by browsing the various BBC feeds from there. There were a few like TV highlight programmes and some stuff on the radio, but I actually found it quite difficult because there's either not very much at all, i.e. like 1 hour long TV programme where Kirsty Walk does the best of the Edinburgh Festival in 2017 and tries to like show you everything in an hour. Or they do like a comedy podcast that's like an hour every single day where they also try and be like, so this was what happened yesterday, which I also find quite hard to catch up with because I wasn't going to listen to 20 days worth.
Totally. But this is the inherent problem of the Fringe Festival, isn't it? Is that there's just so much that you either get this like very, very like basic, not very well explained, like pricey of what's on, or you get like very, very long, detailed, overwhelming guides that are just like impossible to sift through. So I don't know. It just feels like that the festival is so big that it's almost a problem.
Yeah, you want something in between. So, I mean, I ended up listened to a couple of things, one of which was a stand-up set by Hannah Gadsby, who I subsequently learned went on to be the joint winner of the like overall, what's it called? It used to be called the Perrier Award. Now I think it's just called the Edinburgh Comedy Award.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she shared it with John Robbins, who's Sarah Pascoe's ex.
Oh, no way.
So yeah, it's interesting actually that so Hannah Gadsby's show, she's Australian, and it's all about the fight for equal marriage in Australia.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's actually quite sad. I was reading the report, she's giving up stand-up. This is her last show because she said it's just taken such a personal toll.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's really hard.
Which is really sad that she's kind of chucking it in, but you can see why. And she says, like, you know, sometimes touring to regional parts of Australia, she's not felt very safe because of all the homophobia, and, you know, so she's got to do what she got to do. But obviously she is very talented, so hopefully whatever she does next will be equally excellent. I just found it funny that so she won the award jointly with John Robbins, who so both John Robbins and Sarah Pascoe had shows at the Fringe this year about each other.
Yeah, I heard that hers was about, like, being single for the first time since 2001, which is like, that would be so hard.
Yeah, hers was not nominated at all and his won, so I have no idea what that says about
interesting
how they award these things or whatever. But it's difficult to judge without having seen either show, but I have to say, just reading that information made me think, could it be that people are more interested in the man's experience of a relationship?
Maybe.
Or maybe hers was just not as good.
Maybe.
This could also be possible, but probably not. Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I didn't go to the Fringe this year, but I have been and performed in past years when I was a student. And you're absolutely right what you say about you. I don't know, I felt like I existed in this constant state of, like, everyone seeing amazing things that I wasn't seeing. Yeah. And feeling very hectic and kind of, whereas actually, the best experiences I had there were often the random ones where you just walked into something because it looked empty and it was raining and it was amazing. Like, I remember me and my friend Brian ended up going about 5 times because we were there for the whole month. And also, if you're a performer, you get a pass for the venue that you're in. You get a pass to go and see anything else in the same set of venues. So you can go to things repeatedly without it costing money.
That's great.
It was a Blues Brothers tribute show that was on at about 11:30 every night.
Oh my
and we
God.
went like 3 or 4 times a week. We liked it
That's
so
amazing.
Much.
Amazing. That's great. Yeah, so much stuff sells out as well that sometimes you can feel a bit like, oh, I'm at this festival and there's, like, all this amazing stuff on, but I can't actually go to any of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, but obviously it's something you've got to do. I'd never done it before, and you do have to go and experience it because it's amazing.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you had a good time anyway. And yeah, if any other listeners were at the festival, let us know what your highlights were. Here you come again. Just when I've begun to get myself together, you walk right in the door, just like you've done before, and you wrap my heart.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So the next thing we're going to talk about this week is The Cuckoo's Calling, which is a novel by J.K. Rowling written under the pseudonym Robert Galbraith. I think that's how you say Robert Galbraith, is it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think so. It's a detective story following private detective Cormoran Strike, who's this kind of like mid-30s, disheveled. It ticks a lot of the classic detective boxes in that, you know, he's down the pub quite a lot and he's in debt and like this is the case that he needs. But it follows the death of a model called Lula Landry, who's got a kind of mysterious background. And the first novel in the series starts when Cormoran Strike gets a new sort of temp called Robin.
The world knew her as Lula Landry. I think she was murdered.
My name is Cormoran Strike. I'm a private investigator.
Robin Ellicott. I'm the new temp.
So you think Lula Landry was murdered and we messed up the investigation?
She was scared.
The chap they picked up on the CCTV, they never traced him.
What on earth would I need an alibi for?
She was frightened of me.
Lula was in the wrong nest.
Leave me alone!
Little Rock knows more about me than you lot ever will.
Where shall I say you are if anyone important calls?
Down the boozer.
So I really feel like it is a very traditional murder mystery in a lot of senses, but with the added joy of it being written by J.K. Rowling, so in this prose style that a lot of us know and love from Harry Potter, and now it's been adapted into a series for the BBC. And I've watched the first one. I'm not quite sure on the release date for this. Did they just like dump it all on iPlayer at once?
I don't think so, actually. I think it was on like Sunday and Monday night of the bank holiday weekend. I think it was one of those.
Ah, I see. Because it's in three parts.
Three parts, yeah.
And so two are out now.
I think that's right, yeah.
Okay, cool. So I just watched part one. What about you?
Yeah, same here. I did read the book last week, though, having not read it at all. Obviously, I'd heard about it when the whole like Robert Galbraith is unmasked as J.K. Rowling thing happened.
Yeah, of course.
But I didn't read it at that point because I don't tend to read a lot of contemporary crime novels, actually. I'm more into the, you know, 20s and 30s ones. I read a lot of those ones. Yeah, so it's interesting. My friend Tracy had recommended it to me a few times and she described it to me as trashy in the Dan Brown way, but good, which is a description I can, now having read it, I can see where she's coming from, because it is quite typical/cliched in lots of ways. As you say, the detective character fulfills lots of the angsty qualities that they often have.
Yeah.
And there's lots of things taken as read. You're supposed to be fairly familiar with some tropes and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the plot is pacey and I did want to know what happened. So it is good as well. You know, it isn't boring.
Totally. I haven't actually read The Cuckoo's Calling, but I read the first 200 pages of it and I'm going to try and like finish the book before I've, you know, I want to try and read slightly ahead of the adaptions.
Mm.
I just find her prose, even if you don't think it's particularly like literary or stylish, I find it just like getting into a nice warm bath. I found it so easy and so comforting to read. So, you know, I loved that element of it. I'm not like a crime fiction obsessive. So I don't know how it stands up to other sort of contemporary crime novels, because the other crime novels I've read are sort of like Agatha Christie and like the occasional, you know, like when Gone Girl goes massive or something like that. Mm. So I don't really know how it compares to kind of like its competitors in that area. But yeah, for me, it's just like a great read.
Yeah, there are certain things about it. And I'm not going to say what happens because you haven't read it and also listeners might be watching it still. But there are also just certain things about the plot and the way it works that I feel like take it over and above your basic crime novel. Like, for instance, there's quite a lot hinges on the fact that a witness to Lula Landry falling, who's a woman who lives in the flat below her, who is adamant that she heard somebody arguing with Lula just before she fell, thereby indicating that she probably didn't jump, she was pushed. This witness gets completely discredited by the police because she's a woman who's taken drugs in the past and all this kind of stuff. And I feel like Rowling puts quite a few of those points in, kind of where she says, this is what people might think about this person, but this is what's actually going on with them. So yes, this person maybe has mental health issues, or maybe this person is disabled, but look, actually, this is what they've got to say.
Yeah.
And in that way, she takes it under the cliche a bit, which I think was good.
So as someone who's read the book and seen some of the adaptation, how do you think it, how do you think it functioned, like, as an adaptation?
Well, it's pretty faithful from what I've seen so far. I've only seen the first one. They've sort of sanded off a few of the rougher edges. Like, I was quite startled to see that they've altered the way that Robin and Cormoran and Strike, the detective, meet slightly.
Oh, yeah, they have.
In the book, she, you know, comes up this big flight of spiral stairs up to where his office is, and at the very moment she gets to the door, he opens the door outwards and knocks her over, and she would have gone all the way back down the stairs and probably really hurt herself. But in the book, he grabs her by the boob and pulls her in.
Yeah.
Which I actually quite liked as a sort of strange meet cute in the book, because I was like, well, that's very awkward for everybody, and thereby gets the conversation flowing. And also establishes the fact that theirs is not going to be a kind of sexual relationship, that theirs is going to be a kind of professional and relationship full of camaraderie and that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. That's interesting.
But in the adaptation, there was no boob grabbing. He just grabs her coat and pulls her. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. They've toned that down.
It would be hard to choreograph.
Yeah, maybe, without actually hurting the actress's boob.
But I don't know. I'm sure they could have done it. There's obviously other things that they've managed to... But yeah.
Well, they've managed to make it look like, oh, I think, is his name Tom Burke, the guy who's playing Cormoran Strike? They've managed to make it look like Tom Burke has lost part of his leg when he hasn't.
Yeah.
Which I read quite an interesting little piece. The director is slightly reluctant to reveal exactly how they did this, but he did say it involves green screen and a body double.
Interesting. Yeah, because there were parts where I thought maybe it was just two separate people and they had, like, you know, above the waist shots and below the waist shots, but they did seem to, and then there are a few shots where you do see Cormoran Strike sort of like his whole body in one go. But yeah, I like the character a lot, and I know that the character of Cormoran Strike is one that is kind of built from cliches, really, like troubled, violent past, dealing with war trauma, girlfriend who's left him, or, you know, he's left her, you know, recently broken down relationship, money troubles, likes his alcohol, like gruff, seems a little rude sometimes, disorganized, like all these things that are just, you know, by the book cliches of like what a kind of grumpy crime detective would be like. But it works, doesn't it? It works for a reason. And when she does kind of play around with stereotypes, J.K. Rowling always does it really, really well. Like, she like makes sure that people are always 3D. Like, you never don't buy her characters, I think. So it works for me.
Yeah, it does. And it's not completely groundbreaking in any particular way, but I feel like it's a very good example of an established form, which I think makes sense with how she came to write it in the first place. Because I think I'm right in saying that part of the reason why she did it under a pseudonym in the first place is because she was just doing it for fun. Like, she just wanted to try a different kind of writing and, like, slip into a different genre after... And you can totally see why, after obviously all the Harry Potter success. And then you remember the huge amount of pressure and fuss there was when The Casual Vacancy came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, they had that rule that critics were only allowed to, like, see a copy at the publisher's office, and they weren't allowed to have a pen in the room with them and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so terrified they were that it would leak, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can see why she would quite like to, oh, I'll just write a crime novel and put it out under a different name, totally. And that will actually be a fun writing experience for me.
Totally, yeah. I have to make a diversion briefly to just say that while I was in Edinburgh this week, I also did a Harry Potter tour and went to some of the places that, you know, J.K. Rowling supposedly wrote bits of Harry Potter in, and, you know, things that inspired her and stuff. And it was really cool. I'm such a nerd, but I found it so fun, like, going to the graves of, you know, people called Tom Riddle, who inspired, you know, character names, or like the William McGonagall plaque that apparently gave her the idea for Professor McGonagall, and just stuff like that. And also hearing, you know, this is a well-worn anecdote that I'm sure many listeners have heard before, but about her, like, writing the final chapter of Harry Potter in the, I think it's called the Balmoral Hotel in Edinburgh, the, like, really big posh one. and like in the penthouse suite on the top floor, and then like finishing it and like being really overwhelmed and just like glugging half a bottle of champagne from the minibar and like scrawling on a bust of Plato like Harry Potter was finished here by J.K. Rowling on this day. And it's like still, it's now like in there upside down, like in a glass jar so that you can see what she's written on it. And I was just like, oh my God, can you imagine that life? That would be the dream life. Like, it's just so, it's such an insanely decadent and also like literary story. It's just kind of irresistible. So yeah, it was fun to sort of like be at the site of some J.K. Rowling writing places this week for me.
Yeah, and she's carrying on with Robert Galbraith, isn't she? I think there's two Cormoran Strike novels.
There's three, isn't there? Is there three?
Oh, right.
I think there's three. I think there's The Cuckoo's Calling, there's The Silkworm, and then the most recent one I think is called Career of Evil. So yeah.
Because, I mean, I won't say anything else, but at the end of this one, they do very much like set it up to carry on. Like the case is finished, but the characters are, you can see how they would easily move into the next thing.
Oh, that's great. Well, there's apparently they've already filmed like 7-hour-long episodes of the adaptation as well. So it looks like it's, you know, it's very much a series that hopefully will continue.
So now we have arrived at the part of the show where we talk about something that we were recommended by you listeners. And this last week, we've been enjoying Love in Recovery, which was recommended to us by Emily Fox. Just a quick reminder, it's a BBC Radio 4 programme. It's got 2 series already and a third one is just about to start. And it's about 6 members of an Alcoholics Anonymous group. It's set in the room where they have their meetings and the drama kind of follows from there. They talk about their stories and what's happening in their lives, really. So, Anna, how did you get on with it?
Yeah, I thought this was amazing. I thought it was really, really great. I don't know what you thought, but I just think the strength of the cast is so good that it would have to work quite hard to be bad with such great acting.
Yeah, so it stars Rebecca Front and Sue Johnston were 2 voices that I recognised immediately.
Yeah.
And then it also has Eddie Marston in it as well, I think.
Yeah, he's the one who is in Happy Go Lucky, and he was also in the BBC miniseries of Little Dorrit. I always remember his performance in that, which was very sort of like snuffling and like, I don't know, it was good, weird and animalistic. Yeah, so I think with those kind of cast members, because it is also the kind of thing that really, really depends on a great cast, because, I don't know, they're almost monologues, right? There's so much dialogue, obviously, because it's radio, that you just need really, really good acting to carry it off.
Yeah, I mean, I sat down to listen to 1 episode of this and got through 3 without even really realising it. But I was particularly struck by that in, I think it's the first one, which is Rebecca Front's character is the focus of that one. She plays Fiona, who is a former sort of high-flying investment banker, and all the wheels have suddenly come off her very flashy, exciting life because of her problems with drink. And she starts off the episode like, oh, I don't know why I'm here, my work's just made me calm, all this kind of thing. And then it gradually unravels into her doing this long, like, must be 15 minutes monologue.
Yeah.
It's the bulk of the episode where she explains how she's ended up where she is and what happened to her. And the other characters barely say anything, you know. And so it's all hinges on her vocal performance. And that's repeated in other episodes. Each character gets one as the kind of focal point. And yeah, so the writing is very strong. But as you say, yeah, I'm not sure it would work without those particular performances.
Yeah. And there are some really poignant lines. Like the writing is excellent. And I think, did you say last week that the writer, Pete Jackson, has been in AA himself, maybe?
Yeah, well, that's what Emily says in her email. She says the writer was an alcoholic and it's written from his own experience.
Yeah, so I think that definitely comes across. There are a couple of lines that just, I don't know, does Fiona say something like, you can't be an alcoholic if you're like always drinking with friends and like having fun, but then again, you have loads of friends when you're really drunk, which is like a very good way of putting that sort of like that kind of alcoholism that can sneak up on you, where you think that you're just like having fun and that you're just like a party person because you're not like crying alone in your flat like 2 bottles of wine deep, but that's actually not, like, alcoholism can function differently for different people.
Yeah, did you hear the episode with Julie as the main focus as well?
The second one, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that, I think that one I found, if anything, even more powerful, where she's, you know, she's a, how is she, old is she supposed to be, 64, something like that?
Mm.
And she didn't even start drinking till she was 60, when her husband of 40 years,
yeah,
who
40
by the sounds
years.
Of it had
God,
it always just... had his own problems with drink, and she'd always had to be the one, so he got to be the fun one down the pub who everybody loved, and then she would have to put him to bed afterwards and put up with all the abusive things he said to her while she was helping him.
Yeah.
And then he left her, and she was like, I'm 60, I'm going to be the fun one in the pub for a while.
Totally.
And that's how it all came apart for her.
I really like the aside in that where she says, she's like, oh yeah, my husband left me for the cleaner, who ironically turned out to be a dirty bitch.
Yeah, that was funny.
Like, it's obviously not like a feminist joke, but it's just so funny.
Yeah, I really love Sue Johnston's character in it. She's, I think, yeah, having listened to three and a bit episodes, she's my favourite so far.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, I thought it was great. I actually, it's the kind of thing that I just wouldn't have come across if it wasn't for the recommend, so... Thanks so much for what a great recommend. Keep ones like that coming, please.
Yeah, definitely. And as I think we said before, we listened to the first series on Audible. So if you have an audiobook subscription or anything, you can get it there. And then the third series is due to start really soon, I think, on the radio. And there are a few episodes left of series two still up there. So we'll tweet out the links to those and things so you can find them if you want to give it a go.
And speaking of listeners emailing in with great recommends, next week, we thought we'd do something that has been recommended to us literally loads of times by different people. So,
yeah, including by someone in the audience at our shout out festival thing, do you remember?
Yeah, so true. So loads of people think it's good. So just to name some names, some people who've emailed in to recommend this programme to us include Anna Saxon, Janine Nolte, Leslie Gale and Karina Torrios. I hope I said that last name right. It's called Terrace House. And it's a Japanese reality programme. So it's called, the season that we can watch is called Terrace House, Boys and Girls in the City, I think.
Okay.
So yeah, Japanese reality show, premiered on Netflix in 2015. And I think the like bio on Netflix just says, friendship fights, intrigue and even love, six real life strangers, one house, countless cameras. And it just basically follows the day-to-day lives of three girls and three guys who live in a house together in Tokyo. So it's not like Big Brother, because they can go in and out of the house and they can like continue living their lives, and you know, they don't have to give up their jobs. It's just literally they live together.
So it's more like a housemate scenario, but just with people you don't know.
Exactly. And they're allowed to look at their phones and like tweet and whatever they want. So yeah, it's kind of like a reality TV show, but they've taken away some of those more formal constraints, or those like more, I don't know, sometimes it can feel, Big Brother can feel a bit silly when you're watching people like cry about not being able to contact their, you know, boyfriend that they literally saw 3 days ago. So it doesn't have that element of it. I've watched like a bit of the first episode, and we were still sort of like being introduced to all the characters and stuff when I finished watching that. So I think it's maybe a bit of a slow builder, but they also have these like talking heads where they've got like, I don't know if they're big celebrities in Japan or whether they're literally just famous for doing this show, but they have like people talking about like, hey, I like that guy who's brought a sewing machine. He seems really cool and he's really handsome. And like, you know, they have kind of like running commentary at the same time, a bit like the kind of after Big Brother show. But like,
okay, that's quite fun.
Yeah. It's obviously in Japanese and subtitled, if that
okay.
wasn't
a part. I'm excited to give this a go. This is definitely something I would not try if it were not for Seriously, so.
Yeah, but it's definitely like hitting the mainstream, I think, because it's probably because it is on Netflix, but I've seen lots of people talking about it. So we'll give it a go.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, come back in 2 weeks to find out what we thought of Terrace House.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
On seriouslypod.com, you'll find all our back episodes, including our specials on Harry Potter, Love Actually and Friends.
We're also available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
If you've really enjoyed this episode, why not go to iTunes iTunes and give it a rating and a review. It helps other people find the show.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.